let's go ahead and get started. I have one practical announcement to make. I said last time I thought we should skip July 7th because it's the July 4th weekend and because personally it was going to be a little difficult for me, but I can do it. I realize now that we really have to do July 7th, at least if we want to finish this session before the retreat, which starts on August 8th. Because if we include July 7th, then the last session is August 4th, I believe. So we will go ahead and do a session on July 7th, and we'll finish up then on August 4th, and then the retreat on the 8th. And just in case, I think everybody here is given, everybody who's online today certainly is given plenty of thought to the retreat. And most of you, in fact, are going to be there. We have a nice group. I think we've mentioned that before, but we have about 10 people coming. About seven or eight of whom are longtime regulars to this class. So we will have a chance to really practice well and also think about the future development of TSK in a variety of ways. There are a lot of ideas in the air and a lot of plans happening. Okay, I just realized I didn't actually turn on my video, and that's not because I'm being shy today. It's just because I forgot. So let me get the video on. Okay. Let's see. There we go. Okay, so we're ready to roll. So this chapter is, I guess, not the last chapter in the time section. But no, it's not. It's the next to the last. But it's very important and really cumulative. I think one of the things that we realized from having worked our way slowly through the whole section on time and dynamics is I think there's a building power here, a building sense of what it would mean to conduct time differently. That's not the only way to say it. But for our purposes today, I think that's fine. What it would mean to conduct time differently. The power of that is something we really want to explore. And there's something that comes up in the session today that I think is, you know, just a single sentence, but I think it's tremendously important. And so I want to call our attention to it. So mostly today we're going to focus, I think, on the first page or so of the reading. And then we may have a chance to go a little further. But there's some practice I want to do at the end of the first page. And then we'll have the opportunity to discuss that. So let's go pretty carefully through what Rinpoche says here at the beginning of the chapter. The fundamental point that he's making is that we're not free, really. He doesn't use that language here, but you remember in the last session, or maybe even the one before that, he says something like, you know, inquiring into the nature of time means asking at a very fundamental level whether we are free. And from a time perspective, you could say that that is the payoff in TSK. First, we need to understand or acknowledge that we are not free, that we are conditioned, that we follow out the same patterns again and again and again. And then we need to see how that's related to our ordinary understanding of time. And then we need to see what to do about it. We need to investigate the possibility. And again, I'm using the language of this chapter. You could say it differently, but we need to investigate the possibility of conducting time differently. So the way Rinpoche phrases that here is to talk about change and living in a world in which there really is no change or in which change is exceptional. So on one level, you can say you know, things are changing all the time. We do insist in a very mistaken way on things being permanent. But if you ask someone on the street, you know, do things change all the time? They'd probably say yes. The other side of that is you know, the old saying, the more things change, the more they stay the same. And I think that that's the level that Rinpoche is pointing at here. Yes, there's change from moment to moment, but the patterns are repeat themselves over and over again. This kind of theme always reminds me of something that Henry David Thoreau wrote. He said he was talking about why he doesn't read newspapers. I think this was, you know, 150 years ago, but he said nothing of any interest has been published in the newspapers since the invasion of the Spanish Armada, and that was, I think, in 1588. So about almost three centuries before he wrote, over four centuries from our time. The point he's making is the kinds of changes that we get so interested in, the kinds of changes you see if you look at any of the popular news gathering sites on the web, none of that matters. Change in the sense that Rinpoche is talking about here is something completely different. It's change in what's possible for us as human beings. You know, there are certain limits imposed on us, and we honor those limits. And it doesn't matter whether we do this or do that or go here or go there. Those changes continue to those circumstances and conditions continue to operate because, as it says in the first line of the reading, because we conduct time in a certain way. What we conduct is the continuity of the same. And the second line is a variation on that same theme. It says, you know, what really happens in our world is that entities interact. And entity here is a broad word. It means a thing or a substance, but in that sense, we are entities. So it's really another way of talking about it that's come up in other classes, in other sessions, is that it's anything that we've identified or given a label to or named in language, right? So if I pick up a pen, what's going on is that the entity that is I is interacting with the entity that is pen. And the interaction, there's really a very limited set of possible interactions. Once the I is there and once the pen is there, I can pick it up, I can write with it, I can drop it, I can ignore it. But it's all pretty much determined by the basic move, which is to identify the entity. So when we talk about entities interacting, you could talk about identified entities interacting. So one question you might ask there's two questions that might come up here, and they're, I don't want to spend too much time on them because until you really get into it, they're kind of theoretical. But one question would be to say, well, is time itself the conducting, you know, we conduct the continuity of the same. Is time the conducting, or do we conduct time? And ordinarily we say in TSK, we say the latter. We say we conduct time. So you could say that leaves time itself unidentified. And if we say, can we conduct time differently, we may not have gotten to the fundamental level where we say, but what is time? And yet I don't think that's exactly right, because you could just say time is what we conduct. And it reveals itself in its conducting. We are always conducting time, and the possibility for freedom or the possibility for the kind of fundamental change that Rinpoche is talking about is a possibility that has to do with conducting time differently. Now, the other question that you might ask is whether we could just not conduct at all. You know, could we somehow engage time differently without conducting time? And you know, perhaps when you talk about certain kinds of very, very powerful meditative experience, there might be some possibility there. I don't think we need to resolve that because that's not at all the path that we're exploring. The possibility of not conducting, maybe if there is a theoretical possibility, but it seems as though we're always conducting because that's how time manifests. You know, we don't, as I say, it's a little theoretical. I don't think we need to debate it, but I wanted to at least point out those two questions. So Michael has a comment here. He's pointing to the drawing by Escher. What is it? Martin Escher? Is that his name? Which shows a hand. I'm sure you've all seen it. It's a hand drawing the hand drawing. There's a hand drawing a hand, which is drawing the hand that's drawing the hand. So it's this circle. And Michael says, Escher's pen drawing is itself interesting. Conducted and the conducting, merging, dissolves the usual boundaries. Well, that's right. That's very interesting. I mean, that is a good example because the whole point, M.C. Escher, that's what he calls himself, the whole point of that painting and drawing, really, and so many of the drawings that Escher does, is to take what's been conducted and in a sense deconstruct it so that you see the conducting, you see the activity of conducting. And that is exactly where we're headed. I think that is right. You know, we're always setting up entities, we're always identifying limits, we're always creating borders. That's how we go about conducting time. That's the energy of time. It's what's referred to at the bottom of the second paragraph here as our dynamic of definition and construction. So let's look at that second paragraph. The idea in the first paragraph is that the way we conduct time depends on entities and identities. And so change becomes exceptional, almost impossible, not quite, but almost impossible. And then in the second paragraph, Rinpoche says, but you know, it's really remarkable that we can do that. I mean, how can we take this flow of time, this dynamic of time, which is the kind of fundamental element that we're looking at, the inward dimension of time, which gives us the aliveness of experience, how can we take that and turn it into something that is static? You know, he says here, each appearance is a dance in time, and that's going to be a theme in the whole chapter. The chapter is called Dancing, a Challenge to the Whole. So each appearance is a dance in time. There are no firm distinctions, but we control that dynamic. We control the rhythm of the dance, and in a way we turn it into something very surprising. We turn it into identified entities. We turn it into structures that we then say are what count as real. And we do that through our own dynamic. The dynamic, as he says at the end of the second paragraph, of the dynamic of definition and construction. So we've looked at that before. There were some exercises we experimented with in the last session, I think, or maybe even the one before that, where we looked at the possibility that the dynamic of definition, as he says here, definition and construction, is itself a dynamic, itself is alive. So if we could tune in, let's say, to the way in which we define things, and in fact, that is what we're going to look at in a moment, from a certain perspective, if we could tune into that, we would have rediscovered a dynamic. Right now we live in a world that's static, but the only reason it can be static is that there's a dynamic of definition and construction. So the most solid frozen world that we can imagine is held in place by an ongoing, alive dynamic of definition and construction. So it's always there. It's always available. From another point of view, you could say there's no escaping it. Sudhi says here, some other approaches to being accomplish this without complete understanding, like the idea that one is directed by the divine force to fulfill his benevolent wishes rather than the self's. Yes, I think that's right. That's good. I think one way to think about that is, if you look at this question, could we conduct time differently? And so the way we conduct time now has to do with the dynamic of the self. The stories that we tell, and there's more in this chapter in the reading for today about the stories we tell, they all center on the self. And if you were to tell a different story, so a story which says, you know, my role in life, the heart of my being is to follow the divine will, that conducts time very differently. And that there's an aliveness in that. It's not, you know, Sudhi says here, there's no complete understanding. I think you could say, if you go back to the classic TSK way of talking about first level, second level, and third level, you'd say that kind of understanding, which tells a completely different story, that could be a second level understanding of time, because you suddenly realize, and you may not understand even that much if you're following the divine will. Mostly people haven't thought about that in terms of time, but you could think about it in terms of a very fundamental temporal shift. And you know, there are, I'm sure, Christian thinkers who have talked about what it means to submit to the divine will in terms of time. So you could do that. But Sudhi is right. That does not, you know, we're going to a level which, at least from our way of thinking about it, is a deeper and more fundamental level. Okay, so let's look at the third level, and that will lead us into some practice, or the third paragraph, rather. What Rinpoche has said is we have our well-defined borders. We rely on on entities and identities, and so change, fundamental change, is not really possible. The reason we can do that is because we're actually generating or relying on a different kind of dynamic, which is the dynamic of definition and construction. In a sense, we're taking the dynamic and turning it in a certain direction, which in the end freezes that dynamic. So it's a very self-defeating thing that we're doing, you could say, but it's what we do and it's how we live. And so now Rinpoche raises the question, well, could we do it differently? He says, can we conduct into awareness the trend toward transformation that flickers at the edge of our truths? So this is really saying, can we awaken an appreciation for the underlying dynamic which we have frozen through definition and construction? And what he adds by asking the question in this way right here, is he adds the idea that dynamic doesn't disappear, that it always is flickering on the edge. It's flickering on the edge of our truth. So it's a little bit like, I don't suppose this is so much true anymore. It used to be true with old television sets. So for those of you who remember cathode ray television tubes, if you look carefully, and maybe this is still true, if you just have to look even more carefully, when you look at an image on a television or a computer screen, there's always a little flicker to it. And normally we just train ourselves to ignore that flicker. But you might say, let's say you had two scenes in front of you, and one of them was being shown on a really good television set, and one of them was real. And you were being asked, which is which? Well, one clue might be to look for a little bit of a flicker on the television image. And that's just an analogy. But the idea here is that whatever we conduct into being, no matter how solid, how substantial, how real in that sense it seems to be, is always at the same time manifesting the dynamic of its own creation. And that's the flicker. So the question that he's asking is, could we become aware of that dynamic as a flicker? And I don't mean literally we have to look for a flicker, although there are practices where Rinpoche does talk in various books, not necessarily TSK. He talks about a kind of a dynamic, I don't think he uses the word flicker, but something close to it, a kind of a flickering quality, let's say, that we may be able to experience in our awareness. So maybe you could think of it literally, but maybe you could just think of it as looking for the aliveness, looking for the moving, shifting, flowing, time-related dynamic within whatever appears. That's the possibility that he raises here. And then he says something, and this is the phrase that I wanted to point to here, because I think in some ways you could say this is at the heart of the TSK vision. That's a pretty strong statement, isn't it? The vision is so vast. There's so many different aspects. But nonetheless, I will stay with it, at least for today, that's at the heart of the TSK vision. And he says, taken as a program for inquiry. So what is it we're taking as a program for inquiry? This possibility of awareness of the dynamic of time, really. Awareness of the constant transformation that's going on in each moment. So if we take that possibility, he says, taken as a program for inquiry, rather than simply a casual thought, the question spontaneously shifts our conducting. So why am I saying that that's at the heart of TSK? Because what we present, what Rinpoche presents in the TSK vision is not a theory. It's not some cool idea. It's not something that's meant to excite us in the way that a new idea sometimes can. It's a program for inquiry. It's a way of engaging your own experience differently. You put your experience at the center and you look into it. You conduct what Rinpoche calls in Love of Knowledge, free and open inquiry. Here he just says a program for inquiry. And that's essential for what TSK is about. You know, when somebody tells you, and people say this all the time, you know, when somebody tells you, I love Rinpoche's books, but I can't get into TSK because it seems so abstract and theoretical, or maybe they just say it seems too difficult. When somebody tells you that, the right answer, and I'm not saying you need to have a big argument with them about this, but the right answer, at least, you know, if you're looking for an opening, for a way to maybe shift that perspective, the right answer is to say, you know, this is not a set of ideas. This is a program for inquiry. Look and see. Ask yourself. And what TSK is about, you know, setting up a framework that allows you then to ask a whole lot of questions, you know, just endless questions. As Rinpoche says again in Love of Knowledge, a rain of questions. They come pouring down. Everything is open for investigation. And if you can learn to conduct that inquiry, that's when the TSK vision gains its power. And that's what it's difficult for people to understand for a variety of reasons. But you know, you are all people who've stayed with the vision for quite some time now. It seems to me, and you can look for yourself in your own experience, that that's a fundamental element in what makes TSK a living practice and possibility. So Michael is referring here, posts something in the chat section on this question about the flickering. He says, our truths seem to be a frozen counterpart of the flickering. Frozen counterpart of the flickering. Now, you know, what makes something true? Presumably it captures something about what's manifested. But then at the same moment, it turns it into an entity, and now it's no longer true because it's an attempt to describe something that is not any more the case. But okay, our truths seem to be a frozen counterpart of the flickering. And if we can keep drawing a sense of meaning from that more dynamic living arising which never quite freezes, we might find a path to freedom and openness. Question mark. So I think you're asking, is that in fact a good way of thinking about what TSK offers? And yes, I think you can say that. The sense of meaning comes not so much from what's said, but from the saying, or rather from the arising, the dynamic living arising, which itself never quite freezes. You know, that's why we can say it flickers. Yes, that's right. And one way to do that, and that's really, you know, a very fundamental way to do it, a description of how to do that at the very basic level, because it applies no matter which element in time or space or knowledge or which book or which chapter, it applies in every case, is through inquiry. You know, it's hard to think of a more general way of expressing it, because inquiry is always available in every moment. So inquiry, you know, the question then you'd want to ask, Michael, based on your comment, is how does that inquiry relate to the dynamic living arising of what appears, of our truths, of the meanings that we impose? And that's a very good question. It's in a way, it's a question about matching up one set of words with another set of words, but it's still a very good question, because words are very powerful and they can lead us towards something that goes beyond words. Okay, so when we take this possibility of discovering the awareness that is not frozen, that is flickering, or of discovering an awareness that is attuned to that not quite frozen element, when we take that possibility as a program for inquiry, that shifts our conducting. And that's also tremendously important, because the point is that as soon as we've asked the question, we're conducting time differently. Ordinarily, people learn to conduct in a certain way, and they're satisfied with the fact that that's the way things are, and it never occurs to them to question. The moment the possibility of inquiry at this deep level arises, they're no longer conducting in the same way. Once the question is there, everything has changed, and it's changed toward greater freedom. And then he says new questions emerge and expand, and then he gives a series of new questions. And that's where I want us to practice right now. The first question is the key, and then he has several variants on it. If we have time, we'll go back and do a second round, but the question that he asks is, what does it mean for a thing to appear in the dance of time? What does it mean for a thing to appear in the dance of time? Or maybe I should state that, emphasize it differently. What does it mean for a thing to appear in the dance of time? So something appears. In fact, something is always appearing. When we look around us, and this is the practice we're about to do, when we look around us, what we encounter is a whole bunch of things, right? And those things appear in the dance of time. You know, that's through the dynamic of definition and construction that things appear. So we've discussed this before, but there's an interesting article in this month Scientific American that's a kind of a update on something that people have explored before. If you restore sight to people who have been blind from birth, they have a very difficult time recognizing what they're seeing. And the reason is because they've never learned how to conduct. They've never learned how to conduct the reality that everybody learns about. So, for instance, there's a thing and its shadow, and we're very clear about the difference between a thing and a shadow, but they're not. They have no way, you know, that's a definitional kind of thing. It's a construction kind of thing. And to them, there's no distinction to be made between a thing and its shadow. So many, many examples like that in the article. It's interesting to look at. But it's just a way of clarifying the fact that what we see is what we've constructed. Right? So you could say a certain answer or one answer to the question, what does it mean for a thing to appear in the dance of time? One answer would be to say, well, it means that we've engaged the dynamic of constructing and defining. That's how something appears. That's an answer, but it's not the answer that this question is looking for, because that's a kind of an explanation. Right? And it's okay to say, okay, this is a good theoretical explanation. It helps, for instance, to point us toward the dynamic of construction and definition. That's a good place to look. But that's only the pointing. If you ask the question, what does it mean for a thing to appear in the dance of time? You need to look at that experientially. You need to look around you. And as you look around you, and all you see is things, And the word thing, I'm mostly referring it now, I'm pretending that it only relates to what we see, you know, the clock, the computer, the statue, the flowers, the painting. Those are some of the things that I see. Things appear in many other ways, not just visually, through the other senses, but also through our emotional reaction and through our history. Michael says, are things the dance partner with two left feet? That's kind of nice. I'm not going to try to work that image out right now, but I think it's kind of it's a good suggestive image. So what does it mean for a thing to appear? Well, the way to ask that question is not to come up with some theory that links together constructing and defining and appearing and all of that. Good, fine and good. It's to look. When you look, and this is what we're going to do. I'm still building up to doing this exercise. When you look, you know, in a sense, you might say it's already too late. You know, whenever you look around you, you see things. But there's still a way of looking in which you can call into question the appearing of what does appear. It's not as though you can slow time down. That's a very ordinary way of thinking about time. You know, if you could just slow it down, you would see the mental processes in our own minds through which something takes form or gets defined. You know, it might be possible to do that. You might find moments when you can do that. But even if you can't, even if all you see when you look around you or all you hear, let's say, when you listen, are things that are already there. It's already too late to see how they've gotten established. Even if that's so, it's kind of like saying, but the flicker is there, right? It's kind of like every element, every entity carries with it the reality of its construction. And that's available even though you can't see it taking form. It's part of the thing that you do see. So there's a series of questions here. I'm not going to look at the last one. That's what we would do if we had time. We don't have time. But you can maybe do it on your own. But there's a series of questions. The fundamental question is the one I have been emphasizing now. What does it mean for a thing to appear in the dance of time? And then some secondary questions related to that. How does it arise? How does it depart? How is its role assigned? How does identity take form? It says in this fluctuating dynamic, there is a fluctuating dynamic, and that's a reminder of the flickering, which is never quite gone. But in that fluctuating dynamic of an ongoing presencing, somehow, and this is the kind of remarkable thing that Rinpoche has pointed out earlier in this page, somehow the identity does take form. So those are all things you might, you know, kind of look at them, think about them right now, but now we're ready to do the practice. So what does it mean? You know, how do you experience? Let me rephrase that just a little bit. How do you experience a thing appearing in the dance of time? And then, you know, secondary questions, how does it arise? How does it depart? How is its role assigned? How does identity take form? Those are all questions. We can't see them happening in the usual causal, linear sense, but all of that is still available in the appearance of what appears, in the appearance of the thing that does appear. So let's take a couple of minutes now and look at this appearing of things in the dance of time with a sensitivity to these questions. And then we'll take some time for people to comment on their experience. So just a couple of minutes, and then we'll come back together. Well, that sound wasn't me, but I'm going to take it as the opportunity for us to come back together. So we're going to give people an opportunity here to comment on that. So David has been diligently writing, and he writes, "Things arise continuously. From the senses, ideas about those arisings, Other ideas are triggered in turn by those ideas. Also, waves of feeling tones seem to be atmospheric as things arise and pass. Movement evolves and morph based on an attraction to the thing. Attention is captured by the movement of some connection between some things. I feel a tendency to organize some arising things, go with them, and develop them further as a stream or string of connections. Good. So that I think points towards the kind of inquiry that you might find yourself doing. Now, you might not be able to specify out the different elements as much, but you might well have a sense of this kind of shifting. But it's important to be clear, it's not, you know, this is not a description where you say, okay, David, you got it right. You know, there isn't a right and a wrong here. There are just countless possibilities for exploring further. So let me just give you an example. I'm leaving some time open for other people to give their reactions. But one of the things that struck me in this particular occasion was how much of the past is present in whatever thing appears in the dance of time. You know, if we were thinking in kind of ordinary materialist ways, we might think about how something gets made. If I look at a clock, there's the past of its arising. But you know, I'm looking at a vase with some artificial flowers that is on a table in front of my desk. And one of the things that came to mind was the person who put that there. And then that triggered a whole lot of things. And that has something to do with how things arise in the dance of time. Okay, Sudhi asks a question to expand on the word finity. That's a word that Rinpoche uses a couple of times in this chapter, two or three times. Please expand on the word finity. Our constructing can accord with the spontaneous presence of a transforming knowledge, dancing the finity of time's presentations. So I think, Sudhi, you're either quoting or paraphrasing something Rinpoche says. And then you ask in parentheses, is finity the same as finiteness? And I think the answer to that has to be no, or he would have used that word. Finiteness is not a particularly nice word. I mean, just kind of an ugly word. But it's a real word, and he could have used it, and he didn't. He used the word finity, which is not a word as far as I know. I'm not going to try to explain that right now, but I will instead put something in the orientation. I'll say something about finity because we're going to move on past this chapter, or past this section rather. So I will say something about finity. I think it's a very interesting term. So Karin has a comment, and I think this will be our last comment. Opening a window in one direction, focusing my interest by asking, what is it? So if I understand you, Karin, you're saying you actually got up and did something during those 2 minutes. You opened the window. But maybe you mean as a metaphor, I'm not sure. Opening a window in one direction, focusing my interest by asking, what is it? Finding answers more or less quickly by the stories around it, not allowing, not knowing. Right. So this dynamic of aliveness, this trend toward transformation, it does seem, and Rinpoche has talked about this extensively in other places in what we've been reading, it does seem as though in order to let awareness entertain that quality of transformation, there has to be a not knowing. You have to be willing to not know the things that we ordinarily define and shape. And that could be a kind of an openness. It's like you say, well, I know this to be true, but I don't know what's going on around the edges. You know, there's a kind of a core that I do accept. Or it could be a not knowing where you find a way to just kind of let the whole thing drop and not know what it is, not let the stories, and Karin's very right, I think, to point towards stories, and Rinpoche does in this reading too, not to let the stories tell you, because the stories are not the flickering dynamic aliveness at the edge of our things, you know, at the edge of our truths. The stories are what give us our truth. They're not going to turn us away. They're not going to let us see what we don't already know to be true. Fundamentally, that's true. Unless you tell a different story, that can have a certain impact. Okay, well, I'll let Michael have one more here, and then we have to stop. Looking at a brick wall behind my computer that used to be the outside of the house, I felt the steady hand of the mason putting an inch of mortar between each brick some half century ago. The present surface feels like a portal into the arising of the thingness that I ordinarily accept as the last word. So yes, that's related to what I said about the pastness of each truth playing into it in the way that we very often or mostly ignore. Okay, I'm going to stop there. Again, in terms of planning, remember that we will meet next Sunday, and I hope that works out for people in terms of their plans for the 4th of July weekend. We will go on to read, I think, the rest of the chapter, if I remember correctly. And in the orientation, I'll say something about the parts of the chapter we didn't discuss. The beginning of this chapter seemed to me so rich that I really wanted to focus there. Okay, talk to you next Sunday.